And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today, as we're here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. Today's Thursday. Normally on Thursday, we've got my friend Christine Franklin on the show. Christine is, if you can believe it, she's off having a vacation and a life. And so today, I thought it would be fun to instead have on my dear old friend, godmother of my old in the sense of I've known her for 35 years.
Since we were infants.
That's right. And
I don't think it's been that long, Mark, but okay, I'll go with it.
How? It's been longer.
I've never sat down and counted, but I don't think it's that long.
Yes, 1980. It's been 36 years, actually. Yes, I've known you for a good long while. Sherry Waddell is the voice that you're hearing on the other end of Skype. And golly, yes, Sherry and I just go way back. We have many adventures. We were received into the Catholic Church at the same Mass after a mammoth struggle to just get into the Catholic Church. You would not believe how hard it is to actually get into the Catholic Church.
Yes, that's what we said to each other as we circled the fortress Catholicism on a dark, dark, bleak Seattle day, as only Seattle can be, in December. And we said there is no way in, and it's a metaphor for everything, the Holy Spirit.
It was. You know, I mean, one of the things that I periodically hear is how the Catholic Church is lying in wait for unwary souls, you know, who they'll just be swimming along in the great ocean of American religious culture, and then suddenly the Catholic Church, like a flounder, will just snap out of the sand and, you know, suck
Excuse
them
me,
in.
You don't actually catch flounders. I grew up on the Pacific Gulf Coast catching flounder and eating flounder. You clearly know nothing about them, but go ahead with these metaphors.
The flounder is the predator in my metaphor. You need to work with me here. So anyway, so we strove mightily and managed to finally crack the code and break into Fortress Catholicus and managed to actually get ourselves into the church, both received into the church at the same Mass. That was on December 20th, 1987, you and I. And it's what a long and strange trip it's been. And Sherry and I go way back. She's the godmother of our oldest son. And the tales I could tell. There are just so many interesting things that I know about Sherry Waddell. But for now, I'll just recap the things that other people probably are familiar with, including the fact that she's the director of the Catherine of Siena Institute out there in Colorado Springs. And I think probably most famously, she is the author of Forming Intentional Disciples, which I think, and I never tire of saying, is, I think, one of the most important Catholic books written this decade. If you haven't read it, then you really should. If you want to understand both the threats, but also the great opportunities that we face as Catholics, and the real potential that we face for a major revival of Catholic faith in our times. And this brings us, of course, to what I wanted to discuss today. Because a lot of people, kind of the dominant narrative, believed equally, by the way, both by secularists who are enemies of any religious faith, but also deeply believed by, I think, most American Catholics, is that secularism on the march And secularization inevitably leads to the collapse of religion and universal godlessness and irreligion and et cetera, et cetera. We've been talking, and you've been pointing out that there's actually no historical basis for that.
Rodney Stark, the famous sort of scholar and sociologist of Christianity and religion, he had a really interesting observation. He said, secularization is a self-limiting process.
Hang on a second. I'm hearing kind of a motor whirring in the background.
There is something in my desktop that is whirring and starting, and I don't know how to stop it.
Ah, okay. That's
it's
weird.
The fan decided to take off.
Okay, I wasn't sure if that was something in Ethan's...
No, I'm not Wesley Dixie. No, that is not...
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, I'm not going to worry about it then. Go ahead.
So, well, Rodney Stark, as he said, secularization is self-limiting. It doesn't lead to irreligion. It leads to revival. Now, this is his famous book, The Churching of America, that he wrote about. And basically, the whole point of the book is he's tracing the sort of rhythm of decline of faith and then revival that occurred over the course of the America's experience in 1776. And because sometimes I think we get this idea that we all know the Catholic Church, most of us were immigrants. Catholics were immigrants in the 19th century, came in great numbers to places like Boston and Chicago and New York and Brooklyn, where I was last month, and all these places. And we know that part, but I think we tend to think they showed up tidy, little, mass-attending, devout, well-catechized Catholics that just needed parishes and schools and whatnot to be built for them. But in fact, that was not the case, because in the early 19th century, basically, in about 56 years, this is what's so stunning. The number of American Catholics grew 770% in 56 years. So if you can imagine trying to envision today's Catholic population, being seven times larger in 50 years, it's staggering. I don't think this has ever happened before in history in any setting that I'm aware of, where just millions and millions of Catholics from all over the world all descended on one country, all immigrated to one place in the course of half a century. And basically we went from 1 million to 14 million Catholics in 56 years. Yes. And that, just having people just pour in all the time, that makes an impression. You have that happen for three generations and you think, hey, whoa, that's the way reality is. That's the way it's going to be. The thing was, when they showed up, most of them, or the majority of them, probably weren't practicing, as far as we can tell. All the historians and all the people at the time talked about the fact that most of these Catholics, of course, who were working class, poor Catholics, looking for an opportunity, they had not only not been educated, but they had not been catechized. Many of them hadn't received First Communion. They weren't attending Mass anyway back home. And they often said that the only thing they knew was that they're from a Catholic country, and therefore they presumed they were Catholic. It was that bad. So it was very, very interesting as these vast, and this included the Irish, who we now think of, as traditionally super, super devout, but none of these countries were. In the early 19th century, in the late 18th century, religion, Christian faith, had declined gravely and seriously all over Europe. It was a sort of a universal phenomenon. So they came from places where the church's life was at a low ebb anyway, and they weren't catechized and they weren't practicing. And then they came to a country that didn't have a lot of Catholics in it. and where the number of priests was very small, and where the number of parishes was very small. And so in some parts of the United States in the early 19th century, there'd be one priest to 10,000 Catholics, that kind of thing. Numbers Yikes. That we now think of as belonging to Asia or Africa or someplace like that. But that was the way it was in the early United States. And so what happened is that actually European priests, several European missionary groups were established just to send priests to go and evangelize those pagan Americans. And because they had their images, of course, of cowboys and Indians and wilderness as far as the eye could see, which of course didn't describe a good deal of the country. But they came, they were itinerant evangelizing preachers who put on missions for the laity, and they called them revivals. That was their term. And I mean, they would do these
That's interesting to me. That's interesting to me just because, you know, revival is one of those words that I think most contemporary Catholics would identify as a Protestant word. Mm-hmm. And we don't do that kind of thing. So this is really interesting because it's I think it's a chapter in American history that a lot of Catholics are unaware of. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Waddell, the author of Forming Intentional Disciples. And we will be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with a special guest, Sherry Waddell. What? Sherry Waddell, who is winner of the Colorado Springs Catholic Intentional Disciples Bathing Suit Competition, and there's just all kinds of things that you don't know, but I'm here to fill you in, and. And by the way, if you want to join the conversation, this is your chance to talk to Sherry Waddell. So give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can call or text us at that number. You can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. We were talking before the break about the predicament that the 19th century Catholic Church found itself in. Contrary to perhaps popular mythology today, the history of the church has not been onward and upward until the Second Vatican Council, when it all went to hell. In fact, in the 19th century, the Catholic Church was at a very low ebb, not only here in uber Protestant America, where there were only a million Catholics, but also the church was really on the ropes in Europe. After not just the revolution in France, you'd already had the Protestant Reformation. So in large swaths of Europe, the Catholic Church was really taking a beating. But then you have the French Revolution, and the church takes more of a beating. And then you have the great revolutionary era that begins, lots of insurgent communist movements and anti-clerical movements, and the church is just really getting a pounding in Europe, and a lot of people are getting a pounding in Europe too. So a lot of people and millions of Catholics come here, and they're terribly uncatechized. I mean, as you're mentioning, you know, they know they're from a Catholic country. They regard themselves as Catholic because I'm Irish or I'm Italian, you know, or I'm Hungarian or whatever. But, aside from maybe knowing how to make the sign of the cross and perhaps being literate, you know, they've got formation.
Necessarily, yeah. Yeah. It was, they came over obviously looking for, you know, some kind of opportunity, but they weren't by any means devout. So missionaries were sent from Europe, especially missionary priests, but also eventually sisters, came from Europe just to evangelize the immigrants from Europe in the New World. Mm. And one of the big things they did for about 60 years, this was the primary way that evangelization happened, is they had basically parish missions. Now, there were only about 200 parishes in the early 19th century in the United States altogether. So often and these parish missions, they weren't, you know, this, today we have these wimpy little things, you know, you do 3 one-hour talks and a couple nights in a row, and, you know, it's very low key. These missions were based on the whole missionary mission tradition in Europe, which was several hundred years old by that point. So this had been a way to revive the faith of Europeans for generations, that itinerant preachers would go around and hold parish missions that could last up to a month, you know, and they'd be all day, every day, you know, for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, depending on the need. And so they took this pattern that they already knew in Europe and transferred it to the United States. But of course, that meant that they were preaching not in beautiful big churches like we have, because they didn't exist most of the time. They were preaching in log cabins. They were standing on stumps and fields, you know. They were doing it in barns, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, and Catholics were strewn all over the vast, you know, growing West, which in those days was the Midwest in the early 19th century.
Just a little, to give you something of the flavor of what missionaries to the New World faced in terms of uncatechized Catholics. We're all familiar with Sacagawea, right?
Uh-huh.
Accompanied Lewis and Clark and so forth. Her husband was a French-Canadian trapper, a Catholic, and she was his other wife, because he had two.
Yes. That, too, is a very old tradition, yes.
Especially for the French. But that's not, you know, that's the kind of pastoral thing that is faced as this giant wash of immigrants comes to the U.S. But keep going.
So when they would do these missions, see, they weren't just preaching a mission. And of course, they would hear, they were preaching repentance. They were famous. A lot of these missions were famous for their hellfire and brimstone approach, because their goal was to get people who'd lived lives almost unconnected to the church. They, in the time they had with them, they wanted two things primarily. They wanted them to come to confession, and they wanted them to receive the Eucharist. Now, what happened also, though, is that thousands of people there were many conversions, so many, sometimes Protestants showed up at these missions, and hundreds of them entered the church. There were thousands of First Communions, thousands of confirmations. So they were taking care of a lot of backlog, and they would have tens of thousands of confessions. They tracked them. Some of these missions would, you know, you might have 20,000 people going to confession as a result.
Astonishing.
It's astounding. The numbers, well, of course, but they were huge events. They were very popular. They were often done both in the urban environments. Most Catholics, when they immigrated to the U.S., ended up in the cities, in the growing cities. They were working class people looking for factory work and that sort of thing. And so that's why they ended up in Boston and New York and Chicago, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so they often would have these missions at the big parishes. Often they were gender segregated, so they might have a week of solid missions just for women. They often did women first, which was interesting, because they figured if they got the women first, then the women were likely to bring their men. And then the men's mission would follow. There were many things they were trying to do. Many priestly vocations came out of these missions, for instance. In fact, James Gibbon, who became sort of the I think he became the Cardinal Archbishop of Baltimore, actually came to the conclusion he was called to the priesthood at one of these missions as a young man.
Really interesting. You know, what strikes me is how smart this stuff was, too. I mean, these are people who thought about the situation that was confronting them and acted with design and forethought and, you know, not just sort of helter-skelter.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, they weren't making it up in a sense. They were taking and adapting models that had been familiar to Catholics for generations in Europe. But the thing is, we need to understand that not only was the faith at a low ebb in the United States, it was also at an incredibly low ebb in Ireland, for instance. And then there was, in the late 19th century, just like there was a revival in the U.S., there was a revival in Ireland. They call it the Great Devotional Revival. And basically, that was what created the sort of golden era of the early 20th century, where you know, you had parishes everywhere and schools everywhere and lots of sisters and priests and everything, and people attended Mass. They all came out of this multi-generational effort at evangelization primarily through preaching. And so it was really, really interesting. And they had, these were usually religious orders. So Redemptorists, Paulists, the Paulist priests, that was an American group that was established just to do this kind of work. The Jesuits were heavily involved, the Dominicans, the Franciscans. There are at least 13 different communities who were involved in this massive effort that just became, over time, over the decades, it became just to presume that was a normal part of parish life. Yeah. And many times they would have a revival in order to start a new parish, you know, to draw people in where they were planning to start a new parish, because they were, of course, building a lot of them in those days, or to start a new Catholic school, for instance. They would have a revival as a way to begin that, get people, you know, back, basically, back in a state of grace, back in communion with the church, get them sort of connected and enthusiastic about their faith again, and then they would, you know, help build the Christian community in their area. So it was an amazing thing. So the point I like to, when I talk about this, is not that we can do exactly what they did in the 19th century, because we're facing very different situations today, but it was never automatic. And this is what Rodney Stark is basically saying, is when you have secularism, what happens is religious institutions that don't rise to the challenge, that don't become evangelizing, that kind of want to coast on their laurels, they decline, all right.
Yeah.
But what happens is always God basically raises up a new group who are not going to just accept that, who want more, who are passionate about their faith, and who basically lead and are the catalyst of a revival that, you know, just produces, you know, restores the whole church's life. Now, the revival in the United States, remember, we are talking three generations here. So it wasn't overnight, but it was a sustained effort over time, so that 60 years later, you end up in places like Chicago, where you might have 7 or 8 parishes in a 5-square-block area, all for different groups in different parts of the world, speaking different languages. And that's the world, of course, that we presume before Vatican II was normative. We had forgotten the history.
Well, we're up against the break again, but we will be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Waddell, and we'll be.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Waddell. We've been talking with about some of the challenges that the American church in the 19th century met, and really quite impressively, I must say, stepped up and met in a hugely creative way, and in a way that worked so well. Like the mark of my son works in animation. And he says that the mark of really good animation is that you forget that you're watching animation. It erases its own tracks because it does such a good job. And in a certain sense, this is what the American church of the 19th century did. They did such a good job of constructing institutions and welcoming the stranger, the alien, the orphan, the widow, catechizing this tidal wave of, completely unchurched, not just Catholic immigrants too. I mean, they also, they began this huge missionary enterprise to Native Americans, and all the rest of it. They came out here, and I live in Washington, so out west, the Sisters of Providence came out here, and they built hospitals, and they did such a bang up job that we've forgotten that the wall of people that came roaring across the Atlantic at the United States were really, really badly catechized Catholics,
I think somehow we from that experience we sort of presume that if we build it they will just show up,
right?
They will come, literally. If we build it, they will come, because that's what happened for 60 years, and that's, you have that happen for 60 years in a row, and you build thousands and thousands of parishes and schools and institutions and orphanages and all that stuff. Well, of course, that begins to look normal. That's what's going to happen. And the fact that, so now we've been going through 50 years of distress over what happened to that. And basically, we really have to grasp that was a once in a millennium experience. I don't know of any other place in the world or any other point in history where the Catholic Church, grew 700% in 50 years just because people, not because they imported people, but people just came. People just sought them out from all over the world. So it's never going to be repeated. Not like that.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we can't just, stay inside our institutions, and certainly not now, because what, of course, we're dealing with now is that we have these institutions, but people are leaving them, especially younger people. And many, many people are just feel so distant from us, even if they were raised in the church. They have no story there. There's no connection there. There's no real faith. We talk about their faith, but the truth is, in any kind of personal, lived, intentional way, they don't have personal faith. Not as a Catholic would understand it. They have a name. They may be baptized. They may have a more or less Catholic identity at some level. They might feel like there's a whole new group that the Pew U.S. Religious Landscape Survey found recently, and they're basically half a Catholics. There's a ton, millions of American adults who would not say they're Catholic religiously. Maybe they say they're Protestant or they're nothing or something else. But if you ask them, do you think of yourself as at least partially Catholic? They'll go, well, as a matter of fact, I do. And they found, the recent studies just in the last year, found that there were like 9% of American adults thought of themselves as partly Catholic, even though they were not religiously Catholic. Some of them had 2/3 been raised Catholic, but 1/3 of this group had not been raised Catholic. They did not have Catholic parents. They did not have Catholic backgrounds. And they may have thought of themselves, they may have said, well, I'm a Protestant or I'm something else. But they still feel partially Catholic for some reason, which is just stunning. And, you know, so there's all these complexities that we're dealing with in a very different world. And so we're really going to have to rise to the challenge that we're facing in the 21st century, you know, in the creative way that the 19th century Catholics rose to their challenges. Our challenges are very different. We can't just rely, we can't just do or repeat what they did. For one thing, the number of open field missions is probably going to be limited today. You know, and the barns aren't there anymore, and the stumps have probably been pulled. But we'll have to do something. We have to respond in that kind of creative, apostolic, evangelizing way like they did. And the fun thing is, the really exciting thing is to see what God is doing and to run into the number of dioceses, for instance. I mean, there's hundreds of parishes, but also a number of dioceses who, from their bishop, through all of their leadership, you know, right down to the parish level, are choosing mission and evangelization together. They're really stepping out and doing different things.
That's and really great to hear.
It is. It's very exciting.
Yeah, because, I mean, as Paul VI said, the church exists to evangelize. That's what it's for. It doesn't exist to do maintenance. The church... Patton once remarks, he says, I don't want to hear from my troops that we're holding things. We're not holding, we're advancing. And that's very much the attitude of the church. It's when Jesus says that the gates of hell will not prevail against the church, that's an image from siege warfare. Mm-hmm. Ancient siege warfare. And gates, you don't attack things with gates. Gates are closed, and you're keeping the besieger out, and it's the church that is the besieging army, and it's hell that's on the defensive. And so this notion that, which is always a temptation, you know, as Rodney Stark points out, that, well, okay, we built our institution, and now we'll just kind of wait around.
Now we're done.
People to come. We're done. We finished. Yeah.
Okay. But we won't have to do this again. We're done. We've got great system in place. And we'll just pass it on to our children and their children and their children and their children because, you know, we think they'll just take it.
And yeah, course, everything will.
We live in a totally different world. And that is like the absolute opposite of what our culture is doing. Our culture is actually penalizing all religious groups, not just Catholics, who depend upon inherited religious identity. And they're actually supporting, you know, unintentionally, but they are, in fact, the culture, in fact, sort of supports and rewards religious groups who actively evangelize, who actively go out and do mission. Yeah. And it's really fascinating. But of course, we knew that before. It's interesting, the 19th century was like that. It rewarded those who went out on mission. You couldn't just sit there and wait for them to, you know, sort of find their way to the log cabin church 100 miles away.
Right. And the faith is in its bones. It is an aggressive missionary enterprise, aggressive in a good sense, enterprising. It sets out to what did Jesus do? Jesus says he came to seek and save the lost, not to, you know, he didn't just like, well, I'm going to be here working on the furniture. And if anybody wants to like come to me and has any questions, I'll just be here. You know,
that's right. The fields are wide unto harvest, but basically those cotton balls, they'll come to me if they want to be harvested, you know?
Right. Yeah. And so this, you know, this very, ambitious, enterprising, approach to evangelism, which is part of our birthright, not only as Catholics, but especially as Americans. Americans met that challenge in the 19th century with amazing initiative, and it bore tremendous fruit, and we can do this again. One of the things that you touched on a minute ago, and I think it's really important to understand, you mentioned earlier, and it's true, that our culture is an acid bath merely for people who have a sort of received religious identity, and it, not just for Catholics. Catholics often, because we have a history of being, you know, a minority in a Protestant country, we've often tended to speak of ourselves as, you know, always in danger from the larger culture and so forth. And that's true, but it's not simply directed at Catholics. It really goes, you know, Muslims are struggling with this. They come here, you know, and you know, they see their youth, you know, sort of dissolve their religious. Everybody's
doing it. Protestants are seeing their people disappear. Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, any kind of religious tradition. Right. We're all dealing with the same cultural forces.
And yet the paradox, and this is the interesting part, because that's the narrative that most, I think, a lot of especially devout Catholics hear all the time, and they fear and they worry about. The culture is dissolving our religious identity and so forth. But there's a flip side to this that is really interesting, and we'll return to this after the break, because this flip side is full of opportunity for the church.
Absolutely.
And so I want to talk to this when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Waddell, author of Forming Intentional Disciples. And we'll be back right after this. Take it, Ludwig.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
The Dots, the most connecty-dotty radio show in Catholic radio history. More dots connected on this show than any other. And dots, we got terrific dots, okay? Best dots.
Best dots ever.
And we're here today with Sherry Waddell. She's the author of Forming Intentional Disciples. We've been talking a little bit about the threats and opportunities that face the church today. We hear so often the narrative of decline, and sure, there's that aspect of things. But in addition to the fact that we've got a culture that is an acid bath, that dissolves inherited religious identity, which is that's the narrative that you know, devout conservative faithful Catholics hear and fear and worry about. But there's a flip side to this that you point out that I think is extremely important, that is full of hope and promise, and so I'd like you to discuss that a little bit.
Well, okay, for one thing, based on what I've seen in the last 5 years, I would say God is doing something new in our generation that is really exciting. You know, in the over 25 years that I've been a Catholic, I've never seen this kind of stuff going on. I've never seen the level of conversations we're having now at the parish, at the diocesan level, nationally, internationally, where people are really grappling, and we're in the early stages of grappling with the necessity of calling our own to intentional discipleship, to consciously follow Jesus Christ as his disciple in the midst of his church. And that's, you know, and that conversation, instead of just Catholic identity, is hugely, hugely important. Because, of course, that's what Jesus basically told us to do, was go out and make disciples of all nations. He didn't say go out and make, you know, give a Catholic identity to all nations. It goes beyond, so far beyond identity. And so what is really exciting is that we're seeing, not only seeing hundreds of parishes, pastors, bishops, dioceses, not only in this country, but other countries, who are together, are basically intentionally setting out to change the conversation, to say, we are going to ask our people, where are you in your lived relationship with God, you know? And that we're going to talk about Jesus. We're going to propose him. We're going to call them to discipleship. We're going to walk with them. We're going to foster this kind of conscious, living, passionate Catholicism, intentional Catholicism, with Christ at the very center. And what we're seeing, actually, which is really fun, just very recently, we're starting to see some whole new positive statistics out there that really caught my eye. In 2014, for instance, most of us don't know, but after 8 years of decline in the number of adults entering the church, the number of American adults who became Catholic in 2014 rose 12%. The ones who were baptized rose 12%. Hmm. Well, that's the first time in 8 years, because it's been plummeting in the previous 8 years. So what's going on there? That's really interesting. Catholics in their 20s suddenly started reporting an increase in mass attendance. Okay, and you're thinking, well, where did that come from? Lots and lots. There was one particular study that looked at lapsed Catholics. They only talked to Catholics who weren't practicing or who had jettisoned the identity. And they said, are you rethinking your coming back to the church? Are you rethinking your relationship to the church? And 26% of these people in the United States said, well, as a matter of fact, I am. And what's fascinating is 75% of them said it's actually because of Pope Francis. That he was... What's fascinating about watching him is he's building millions of bridges of trust with people of all backgrounds who don't make people who are ex-Catholics, people who hate Catholics, people who don't know anything about Catholics, people who are nothing. But he is so intriguing. He builds bridges of trust and he rouses early spiritual curiosity. And one of our friends on the forum, he was so funny, he's a full-time evangelizer. He said he was standing, you know, in the line of one of those papal masses last year, last September, in Washington, D.C. He said it was like evangelizer's heaven, because all he had to do was just turn around to the person standing next to him and say, so why are you here? And there's an evangelizing conversation right there. And he said what was amazing is the vast majority were not hardcore Catholics. I mean, that was my presumption. The people who would fight their way through that, of course, would be serious, hardcore practicing Catholics. He found himself surrounded by people who were anything but. They were atheists. They were agnostics. They were nothings. They were...
prostitutes, tax collectors.
They had mohawks. They were super environment. They were all kinds of stuff. But what they weren't was Catholic. And they all had come to see him. And he said, I was talking to people. I was praying with them on the spot. He said, man, it was evangelizer's heaven.
Isn't that something?
It was truly just, and in fact, even in my own town, somebody wrote in and said, he said, literally a guy had come from the hospital across the street from his particular parish. The man who was there visiting his mother, who was dying, he saw the Pope on television. He walked across the street into the parish, said, I've been gone for decades. I want to come back. I just saw the Pope on television. Something. So we heard these stories all over the page.
I talked to a guy last year who, after the Pope visited the United States, he said some woman called his parish. She was like, I think she was like 80 years old or something. And she said, you know, I left the church when I was 20 or something, you know, but I want to come back. And it was because of Francis's visit to the United States.
So there's people, there's a really surprising openness. A lot of those people who said, you know, hey, I really feel partially Catholic. Well, like 40% of them said, actually, yeah, I'd be willing to come back. You know, there's a lot of people who have left, but they haven't either severed the ties entirely. Like the rest of us, they're in motion. This is just a snapshot in time. Right now, you know, they've left and walked away, but that doesn't mean they can't come back or won't be ready to come back at some other point in their lives. And so we have to understand the Holy Spirit. There's lots and lots of opportunities out there to bear witness and to walk with people. That same bridge that they used to walk away on can be used as a way back. And if you and I are thinking like evangelizers, you know, we have to have apostolic thoughts, not sort of barricade, you know, everything's falling apart thoughts, but we're confident in the work of God and the power of the Holy Spirit in our generation. We know there are millions and millions of spiritually hungry and seeking people out there, and that what we have to share is really good news, and, you know, and go out there and share it.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, you know, a lot of these people are what you call low-hanging fruit. I mean, they're
exactly.
They're ready, you know, to come back. They, sometimes it's just all you got to do is ask. You know,
would I mean,
you
like to come with me to Mass? There are moments that I basically just want to walk around my town, Colorado Springs, which is famously the Evangelical Vatican, and just, you know, talk to total strangers and say, hey, what do you think of the Pope? I mean, yeah. It's just like instant. You know, I do that to my Starbucks person. She goes, oh, I just love your Pope. So I'm saying, oh, why? Tell me more, you know?
Yeah.
It's there's all kinds of amazing opportunities to do that if we have that sort of attitude, that mindset, and that confidence in God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things is that people who sell, there are people who sort of, they identify themselves as quote unquote religious Catholics. They're there because they, you know, they believe the teachings of the church. And then there are people who self-identify as kind of cultural Catholics, if you will. Not all of them Catholic.
I mean,
not all of them were raised Catholic. They just, they like Catholic.
They're not even baptized. They're not baptized. They're not catechized, but somehow, and I know a guy like that,
who
his parents were non-practicing Catholics. He himself was never baptized and never had, they never went to church, anything. But if you had asked him, he'd say he was Catholic because that's the only religious identity he knew anything about that was linked to his family.
Right. And people can be attracted, you know, to the church for those kind of cultural reasons. And it can sometimes be easy for the devout and the religious to look down on that. But the reality is that that can also be a real bridge of trust that people cross.
Oh, absolutely.
Later on, or they're already in the process of crossing it.
The Holy Spirit is at work in the life of every person you and I meet, no matter how unlikely they look, no matter how far away they seem, or even they themselves consciously understand themselves to be. Grace is still being extended to those people. The Holy Spirit is still at work in their hearts and minds calling them to himself. And, you know, and you and I can know that, can go out there in confidence knowing that that's the case and say, Lord, what are you already doing here, you know, so that I can, in a sense, join you in what you're already doing in this person's life. And I can build upon that. I can speak to that. I can encourage that. I can pray for that. But we need to be confident in God and his purposes.
Yeah. Hey, Sherry Waddell, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. You can find Sherry's book, Forming Intentional Disciples, at Amazon.com. And you can find Ethan Bolin locked away in the producer's booth at Breadbox Media, doing this show and many others and doing them well. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Steve Gradonis. Until then, bye-bye.